tradition and pageantry of college football lives here. This is the Paul Feinbaum Show, Hour 2 Podcast.
This might be college football heaven.
So more talk about the college football season, where we are as we finally, or do we, are we going to turn the page toward the playoffs? Shihan Jayaraja from CBS. He's a national college football writer, always a great guest here, and we look forward to saying hello to him. Shihan, great to see you. How are you, first of all?
I'm doing great, yeah. Thank you for having me.
It's always good to see you, and let's wrap up 1 week and look ahead. First of all, your reaction a couple of days after the fact. By now, you've probably had a good opportunity to carefully think about what you're going to say here.
Well, you know, to me, it's still the wrong decision. I think that when you have an undefeated Power 5 conference champion that has two SEC games, by the way, in non-conference play and sweeps everything through, it shouldn't be one player going down. That changes everything. We have an example of Michigan. They lost their best offensive player and offensive lineman Zach Zinter and had a bad performance. We didn't just eliminate everything that happened that season. And look, there's a lot of conversation about, well, the SEC should be in the field, that Alabama, Georgia, whoever should be in the field. But this isn't an SEC versus the field conversation. This is a Florida State versus Alabama conversation. Alabama is still the team that just 2 weeks ago needed a 4th-and-31 to avoid losing to 6-6 Auburn. They're the same team that was tied at 3-3 at halftime against South Florida. And so for me, Florida State was still the right decision, and I think it was absolutely a wrong call to put Alabama in the field.
Shihan, a lot of people have compared this to a travesty, unfathomable, you know, the litany of, in my mind, overreactions, but it seems like you're in that camp. Explain.
Yeah, well, I think that for me, look, this is a square peg round hole system right now. We have five power conferences at this point. We have four spots. Somebody is going to get left out. It's a guarantee. And this is one of the most competitive years that we've ever seen from the college football playoff. Obviously, not just were there four or five teams that could have had a chance to be in. I think that you even look at some of the other one-loss teams. I think you look at some of the two-loss teams. This would be a great year to have a 12-team college football playoff. But, you know, if the conversation about who the best teams are, then why isn't Georgia in? Why isn't Ohio State under consideration? I just think this opens a big can of worms for what the college football playoff can be. And I'm glad that we're going to lose some of it, at least, when we expand to a 12-team field.
But to some of the criticism, including yours, is this really going to change the sport because they may or may not have made a mistake? Because I'm pretty fired up about what's coming up in 3 weeks. I bet you are too.
No, and I want to be clear. These are two fantastic matches. I'm really excited to watch both of them. What's going to be most interesting is what happens next with Florida State. Do they start to look outside of the ACC? Do they start to feel like this isn't a long-term home? Because if you're going 13-0 in this league, you're not being treated like you're a member of the SEC or the Big Ten. I think that's the piece of this that's going to be most interesting to watch. I'm hopeful that that doesn't happen. I'm hopeful that we can kind of move forward. But it's going to kind of come down to what happens next as to what kind of implications this will have for the sports.
Yeah, I think you just gave them their best argument, and I don't not that anybody in Tallahassee wants my advice, but I think they now have the rallying cry. Remember all these conversations back in July and August about going to some New York investment firm to raise money. What would motivate you more to move forward than this? Auburn snub in 2004 was the impetus behind where we went next to the playoff, and the BC we moved beyond the two-team tournament. So I think you just gave them something to work on.
Well, I think the question is, right, we just saw the death of the Pac-12, and I think that a lot of people agree, I'm certainly among them, that this was a bad thing for the sport. To lose the West Coast as a college football region of the country is really an unfortunate thing. I don't want that same thing to happen to the Atlantic Coast Conference, one that's also existed for a very long time. And so, you know, look, Florida State, I think long-term is going to be fine. They're going to be able to compete for playoffs very soon, I think, in a 12-team field. But ultimately, I am very curious what ends up happening. And I do think the fact that the 12-team playoff is on the way is a huge deal. You can't ignore that. And certainly for me, it makes me more excited for what comes next.
But I do think, though, it also may want move Florida State to look elsewhere now. They would have two options. I'm just spitballing here, and I'll get you to help me with that as well. But you know, the two options would be the SEC and the Big Ten. And I don't know. I kind of doubt they made any. Florida State made any friends in the SEC this week. So it seems like how would Florida State fit into the Big Ten in your estimation?
Well, I think that this sort of comes down to your philosophy on college football, right? Should it be a super league? Should it be only 20, 25, 30 teams matter? Everybody else is relegated to second class status. For me, that's not how I grew up watching this sport. Certainly, it plays a part that I went to a school that wasn't one of those schools, and I understand sort of what college football was to that community. And so if you're looking at Florida State, if you're looking at Clemson, if you're looking at Miami, maybe it's a good thing for them long term, like you said, to end up in one of these two conferences. I don't think it's good, though, for the other 11 teams in the ACC. I don't think it's a good thing for everybody else who's left behind in the Big 12 or the people who are leaving the Pac-12. I don't think it's a good thing for the sport overall. And maybe there's some short-term benefit to Florida State to looking for a Big 10 or an SEC. But I don't know how long-term this ends up impacting the sport. And to mention your question, Florida State and the Big 10, I mean, they'd have to travel up to Wisconsin. They'd have to travel up to Ohio State. It's already a ridiculous thing that we're having teams from Southern California have to make trips to Piscataway. I think that the fit would be, well, you know, this is potentially a life raft, and I don't know if we see it as much more than that.
Yeah, but Shehan, they're now in a league that made that momentous decision a couple of months ago to include SMU. Let me see if I can remember. Stanford, California. So, I mean, those are now ACC members, are they not?
They are. And I think, though, that when you start to look at where we are as a sport right now, we are in a very perilous position if things keep moving this way. And for me, again, as somebody who loves college football, who wants it to thrive nationally, I think that we are heading down a dangerous path in terms of the future of the sport. And we're really risking isolating out of the 133 FBS teams, a good 100 of them.
Listen, I appreciate your overall and general concern for the sport. We both love it, I think, equally. I just happen to view it differently. But we can leave it there. I appreciate somebody who covers college football that has an open, healthy attitude toward it, that actually cares about everyone else as opposed to just looking at it from a treetop standpoint. I may need to come visit you and get some counseling.
Yeah, come on down anytime.
Hey, Shehan, great to see you. Thanks so much for joining us as we move ahead. I think what we show there is that we can have a civil conversation among people who disagree. We'll get to your phone calls right after this.
Is your schedule too packed to see a doctor about your erectile dysfunction? Well, with Hims, now you can get treated for ED without stepping foot outside your door. They're changing men's healthcare by providing access to affordable sexual health treatments from the comfort of your couch. Hims provides access to doctor-trusted ED treatment options such as chewable hard mints, brand-name treatments like Viagra, or generic alternatives for up to 95% cheaper. The process is simple and entirely online. Just answer a series of questions and a medical provider will determine the right treatment option. If prescribed, your medication ships to you free, no insurance needed. So what are you waiting for? Join the hundreds of thousands of trusted Hims subscribers and get treated. Start your free online visit today at hims.com/Paul. That's hims.com/Paul for your personalized ED treatment options. hims.com/Paul. Hard mints are chewable compounded products which are not approved by or verified for safety or effectiveness by the FDA. Prescriptions require an online consultation with a healthcare provider who will determine if appropriate. Restrictions apply. See website for details and important safety information. Subscription required. Price varies on product and subscription plan.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Go to JetsPizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jets' signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, S-A-V-E. Jets Pizza. Better because it has to be.
We are back, and let's continue. I don't know why I'm singing here, but it's just that type of day. Let's continue with more phone calls, and Chris is up next in Tuscaloosa.
Hey, Paul. Thanks for taking my call again this week. I just got to tell you, you know, it was kind of a double-edged sword. I got in day before yesterday, and my wife was super glad about that, but it opened up a can of worms.
Tell us.
Well, so it was my mother-in-law's birthday last night, and we all went out to dinner, and I was sitting with my father-in-law, and I said, hey, I got on Feinbaum. Let me play the show, and he listened to it, and it was good, you know, and we were talking about in the car, and my wife said, I used to get on the radio all the time, and I was like, what? And she lived in Baltimore for about 10 years, right? She born and bred from Tuscaloosa, right? Huge diehard Alabama fan, right? I know you know what that's like. But she lived up there about 10 years, and it turned out that this is all news to me last night, right? Is that when she worked in the car business starting when she was about 15 years old, and was up there working for Ford and stuff. Well, she had in her time working in car business, she had gotten to know David Langner, you know, the infamous punt, Bama punt guy, right?
Yeah,
everybody knows that. Yeah. And so when she lived in Baltimore, he had a radio show, I guess, during that time. And this was back starting, I guess, when Terry Bowden was coach, but then when, you know, Senator Tuberville, Senator Coach was
Senator
the coach. Yeah. And they used to call her and just give her hell every day. Right. Because they called her the biggest Bama fan on the Eastern Seaboard. So that's my favorite nickname for her now. But, because she had married an Auburn guy, right. From first marriage. And, I got to tell you, when I first met her mother and first met her family, her mother and her sister, we were sitting at Jim and Nick's barbecue, you know, Tuscaloosa, and she and my now wife and she and her daughter had gone outside and some out of the car, and like her mom and her sister turned to me like I'm talking like radar dishes on me and said, listen, we got two questions for you. And the first question is, who do you root for on Saturday? Because they weren't going to have another Auburn fan in the family. I'm telling you, it's a real thing.
Hey, Chris, speaking of David Langner, for those who don't know, David Langner was he the punter?
He was the one who ran him back in.
Okay,
right?
so David Langner is the Greg Gant was the punter. Okay, so Langner is the one who picked the ball up, and there were two guys. I think one was named Neil, and the other one was Langner. Okay, let me go to that story. So I can't. This is like in the mid '80s. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And I've never told this story, and I hope this poor woman is not listening. Because she's a wonderful person, and I haven't seen her in a long time. But anyway, I started. I met this young lady, okay, and I met her. We went out for a while, and Thanksgiving came.
Oh yeah.
And this was a year. I think it was '87. Now that I remember it, the Alabama Auburn game was on a Friday. You remember this? It was a Friday for 2 years. And then it was on it one more time, the famous Cam Newton deal. So we have Thanksgiving. They live in the country. Probably the nicest family I've ever met, okay? They're Auburn people.
Yep. Oh,
and
no. Can't do it.
We finished Thanksgiving dinner on Thursday night, and the mother or father, I can't remember which one, said, let's go into the parlor. I kid you not. And they had a record player, and you know what they put on that record player on Thanksgiving night, the day before the Iron Bowl?
The fight song?
No, good guess. The audio recording of Gary Sanders doing the punt, Bama punt.
Oh my God, that don't shock me at all.
Yeah, he blocked it. Sorry, Langner's got it. I mean, I heard it last week, 2 weeks ago, when I was in Auburn. Langner's got it. I don't know if we can draw it, if we can grab it today, but it is the same play happened. Alabama was leading 16-3. I believe they were ranked number two or number one or two in the country. The winner of the game plays for the national championship, 1972. I think this is right. It's only been 50 years, so sue me if I missed it. and that was my experience into the Auburn world. And by the way, when we sat there and listened to the Punt Bama Punt, I mean, I could have gone to the Vatican and listened to the Pope, and it wouldn't have been taken any more seriously.
Oh yeah, listen, Paul, you should have been on your knees. That was a test. That was a test. Whether you were going to be allowed in. That's how it works.
But it's the
game day experience. You said something on the call when I called in before. You talked about the game day experience.
Okay, by the way, a friend of mine, Bill Newton blocked the kicks. Langner returned them.
Oh yeah. Okay. There's so many iconic plays, and I will tell you that, like, I mean, every married man knows this, right? Men are not equipped to deal with the memory that women have, right? They are able to remember the smallest details of the smallest thing, right? And when being married to a woman who's a diehard fan, right, especially a diehard Alabama fan, like, it's a whole other level. And the game day experience for that, just to kind of, you know, unfortunately, we won't be able to make it to Pasadena this year, but we've been to other games. You know, we were at the first Clemson game in Arizona and things like that. And for Black Friday, I always tell, you know, my mother-in-law, and I took my wife and my mother-in-law up to Birmingham, and I said, listen, I am just, you know, STL, Security, Transport, and Logistics, right? I got no opinion. I'm just making sure everything goes smoothly. And whenever we go to, like, big games, right, that's what it's all about. And when we have to travel by air, you know, and packing and stuff like that, it's not just, hey, getting yourself there, you know, and your clothing or whatever. Like, there's a whole, and when you think of, like, the preparation, like, Nick Saban probably puts his team through, I'd stack up what we got to go through as married men married to, like, diehard Alabama female fans, right? I mean, there's decisions about which shoes you're going to take, what shoe options, you know, what about the weather, like, what weather options. I mean, I'm checking weather, like, a month ahead. You have to, right? And we haven't hit any excess baggage fees, but you just never know.
Well, that's great. Chris, thank you so much for sharing it. By the way, I mentioned Greg Gantt was the punter and David Langer. I believe they played on the same high school football team. The guy that punted and the guy that scooped up the if we can find it, I was telling somebody we were going down to Auburn 2 weeks ago, and one of the younger people on the crew, which would be everyone other than me, and I was describing it. Next thing you know, we're at a meeting, and I heard somebody, I think it was Marty Smith, he was watching it on his laptop. He said, man, you weren't kidding. I said, I had John Forney and I, who legendary broadcaster, we used to have a show on Saturday at some restaurant back in the day, and Greg Gantt was there. He was the punter for Alabama. And knowing me, this is the 80s, I have no filter. So I said, well, Greg, so let's talk about that punt. And he looked at me like, would you like to have your jaw broken? I mean, it was, you don't ask questions like, I mean, I've done that a few. Who's the guy? Was it Billy Buckner who was he the guy with the Red Sox that?
Yeah.
Okay. So somebody brought him to our show one day. I mean, at some point, all of these guys circle back. So Bill Buckner. What position did he play? Do you remember? Was he the second baseman? First baseman? First, you remember? It was first baseman. So it's the ninth inning in, what, 86 maybe? Boston had not won a World Series in 100 years. Now, they've won a bunch since, but they were one batter away from winning it against the Mets, game six on a Saturday night. And it was a ground ball down the first base line. Is that right? All the guy has to do is scoop it up. It's the easiest play in baseball. He bobbled it. They got a runner in. They won it the next night. So he's in our studio one day. He's in for a card show. I bring it up, and he looks at me like, I'm not talking about that. How am I going? Well, I said, like, Well, I don't know what else to ask you. I mean, you are like one of the most famous bloopers in the history of mankind. I have a couple of other stories like that, but I won't bore you. We'll let somebody else do that. Trey is up next.
Hey, Paul, I have a question for you. Besides the first initial statement by Mike Norvell, how do you think Florida State, the AD, and the governor, and all, how do you think they have handled this situation? I mean, Paul, and this is my opinion, I know they're disappointed, and they should be, but, Paul, aren't we supposed to teach these young men about life? And, I mean, isn't it disappointment? Things don't go your way. Pull yourself up. Move on. That right there, besides just teaching about football, those things right – this right here could be life lessons, because I can assure you these young men are going to go through a lot more adversity than this right here. And for it to just continue and continue and continue. And now I've heard we might not play in the bowl game, and there's 15 or 20 of them that's going to protest the bowl. And now we got the – what kind of lawsuit basis does the governor even have? What do you think about all that, Paul?
Trey, I've seen plenty of lawsuits in the last couple of years that had less merit than this. But – mm-hmm. It would not go anywhere. And by the way, when you're part of a conference who's part of a CFP, you cede your privileges right there. I mean, you play by the rules.
Well, what happened to trying to teach these young? I mean, they have a great opportunity to prove to the world how they're playing a great football team.
Yeah, I mean,
they're in a great bowl game.
I don't mind the young people being upset, but some of the lines I've heard this week about those 100 players, how do you go in there and tell them? My question back would be, Trey, how do you go in the Alabama locker room and tell those guys who just beat the number one team in the country for the Southeastern Conference Championship that we're taking Florida State, who played a much easier schedule and who beat Louisville as opposed to Georgia? I'll let you figure out which one looks tougher on paper. One who beat Kentucky by 40 points and one who lost to Kentucky.
Well, I just think this is when you really need to step up and be a leader of young men and explain to them about luck. Yeah, exactly. And it's really disappointing, Paul. And I feel so for Florida State. But, you know, we all know if their quarterback was there, they were probably getting in. They're just not good.
Doesn't matter anymore, Trey. Hey, thanks for the call. We're up against a break. Much more to come right after this.
This podcast is proud to be supported by Jet's Pizza, the number one pick in Detroit-style pizza. Why? It's simple. Jet's is better. With the thickest, crispiest, cheesiest Detroit-style pizza in the country, there's no competition. Right now, get $5 off any 8-corner pizza with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8. SAVE. Go to jetspizza.com to learn more and find a location near you. Again, try Jet's signature 8-corner pizza and get $5 off with code 8SAVE. That's the number 8, SAVE. Jet's Pizza. Better because it has to be.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
Hi, it's Mike Greenberg letting you know ESPN Bet is ready to take you through all the biggest sports moments this spring. The official sportsbook of ESPN has exclusive offers and markets from Scott Van Pelt, Stephen A. Smith, and me, plus many more. From the playoff intensity to finally getting out to the ballpark, there's no better time for sports fans. Sign up today. New users get a bet reset up to $1,000 in bonus bets if your first bet doesn't win. Download ESPN Bet today. What a play.
Must be 21 plus and present in select states. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Terms and conditions apply. See app for details.
We are back, and seems like we have gone to Vegas a couple of times this week. That has been the epicenter of college athletics. You had the National Football Foundation Hall of Fame dinner on Tuesday night, and Tuesday and Wednesday, the Sports Business Journal conference that is always a go-to. This event used to be in New York. We've done our show from there. Couple of times when I think I interviewed Commissioner Sankey a couple of years ago and other times. So we head out there again with someone I don't think we've had a chance to talk to, but I do know Dr. Patrick Risch. He is a professor at at Washington University in St. Louis, and I had the distinct honor a couple of months ago of visiting his class. I wish I had been there in person, but we did it from our studio here. Dr. Rich, thank you very much. It was great to see you then. It's great to see you now.
Well, it's great to see you. And right next to the Olympic rings on our campus, where the 1904 Olympics took place, we now have a Paul Feinbaum statue next to those Olympic rings to commemorate the knowledge that you bestowed upon our students.
Well, I'd like to talk about what you do, first of all, and then we'll get to why you are where you are. And because I was not really aware of how big of a field it is, and you are certainly among the preeminent professors in the land at a very prestigious university, one I couldn't have gotten into, but I had a couple of classmates in high school that did go to St. Louis to that school. Tell us about your curriculum.
Well, Paul, thank you. I feel so fortunate to be at Wash U St. Louis. Our program, our sports business program, undergraduate program, started, ironically, we're here at the NBA in-season tournament because of Joe Lacob, the owner of the Golden State Warriors. His son played basketball at Wash U. That was 9 years ago. I was brought in to run the program. And really, Paul, ultimately, I really am passionate about mentorship, something that I didn't necessarily have when I was an undergraduate. Sports management wasn't as big of a field in academia when I was in school. We have an alumni network, Paul, of 150 people all across the industry. And one of them that's in college athletics happens to be Jill Bodensteiner, the athletics director at St. Joseph's University of the A-10. But it's a pleasure and a thrill to basically play the role of an agent to try to help these kids find opportunities. And I tell you what, I'm working with the cream of the crop. Wash U is an Ivy League-like school. And by the way, at the D3 level, our athletics are pretty good.
Yeah, I was. I've spoken to a few classes in my time, Patrick, but I got out of yours as fast as possible because some of those young guys were just firing away at me and not really knowing.
Got to keep the competition at bay, Paul. I got to keep that competition at bay.
Yeah, I made a mistake years ago of speaking out of school at a class, and I did not realize it ended up on social media a couple of days later, and I was determined not to say too much. Without being able to check everybody's phone at the door, but they were scary. They were that good. I say that with great admiration. So let me talk about what you heard yesterday. There's so much conversation about Charlie Baker. Take us through, number one, being out there, meeting so many people that you've come in contact with on some level, and especially the theme of the day.
Well, let's start with Charlie Baker, as you mentioned. Paul, I don't know if Charlie Baker is going to be successful in getting things done at the NCAA, and that has less to do with him and it has more to do with the bureaucracy that is the NCAA. But I will say this, as somebody that's been to this conference, Paul, for the last 10 years, he is infinitely more qualified and infinitely more ready to do something about the various issues that plague college athletics compared to his predecessor, Mark Emmert. And this is not a shot at Mark Emmert as a person, as a president of a university, as he was many times, but as a leader of the NCAA, he was ineffective. Paul, I've talked to, being in the room yesterday after Charlie Baker spoke, the buzz in that room of cautious optimism that this is a guy that, as Abe Madcourt asked him, what is your goal? And he said, I want to get things done. Now that may sound simple, simplistic, but he is not encumbered by being a lifetime college administrator, a lifetime university academic or administrator. And I think this is his strength. He has been involved in government. And ultimately, I think that his ability to work both sides of the aisle is perhaps his saving grace to allow him to be effective in this role.
You said something fascinating, Professor. He comes from the outside. He was a successful business person. He's a governor, of course. We all know that backstory. But here's where I think a lot of people see the problem, and I'm sure you do as well. He may be from the outside, but all the people that he's leaning on to make this happen are institutionalists. They're lifers, and that worries those who really expect dramatic change at a time when it's needed.
And Paul, it's interesting that you say that, because when he took the stage and he talked about the memo that he had released the day before, a conversation starter about making change in this potential subdivision or whatever you want to call it that gives the schools with the most resources, a different avenue. It was funny, the commissioners of the SEC, the ACC, the Big 12 came on afterwards, and Greg Sankey in particular, you could tell that there was a little bit of, hey, I wish we had been made aware of this. Maybe there's a reason why they weren't. Again, it's a conversation starter, but you're right, Paul. He is working against the fact that there is so much institutionalism. Can he get past that? I believe, I really do truly believe, again, going to these conferences, speaking to a lot of people at the school level, at the conference level, at the NCAA level, that people want to make change. There are a lot of positive stories in college athletics that we don't hear about because we hear about a lot of the dirt associated with collectives and associated with the disparities in revenues. But I do think that Baker at least has a fighting shot, and it's because of the fact that he doesn't come in encumbered by all this weight of history weighing on his shoulders.
So, yeah, I mean, you've been around a lot of these people in academia, and when the first thing you hear is, how come you didn't let me know what you were about to say, it's a very negative sign. You can interpret it any way you want, but it's a way of saying I'm not commenting on the substance. And in some ways, I get the commissioners because they really have the power right now, do they not?
Well, they do. I mean, many people have said before that Sankey, if he was going to be a ruler of college athletics, it would be him because the SEC has just had all the power in college athletics. But, you know, Paul, one person that really impressed me at the conference was this Jerry Cardinale of Redbird Capital. Such an impressive guy. And you talk about somebody who has started a lot of businesses. He thinks that college sports is ripe for an area where there could be private equity investments that you could see coming down the road. Because if we do see a creation of some kind of subdivision where the top 100 resource schools are now providing more opportunities and resources for their student athletes, where is that going to come from? And private equity capital, we're seeing more of it enter the ownership ranks of the NBA, the NHL, Major League Baseball. It hasn't reached the NFL yet, but it likely will. I believe that college athletics is a huge untapped resource. And listening to Jerry Cardinale, boy, he made me a believer. There's a lot of ways that college sports don't leverage the same avenues of generating revenue the way pro sports do. And what was really fascinating to me, Paul, is Charlie Baker said this, and then others reiterated this, is when we see these bowl games coming up in a few weeks and the college basketball season underway, the CFP coming up, they don't know a lot about the fans that come into their building. That's incredible to me, because all I hear about when I go to these Sports Business Journal conferences at the professional level is they've made such strides in knowing who their fans are, being able to engage them. I'm just shocked that college athletics has not done that, but that's the next hurdle for them.
Yeah, and there's a lot of theories on why it hasn't done it, but I want to follow up on what you said, because we saw the first sign of this a couple of months ago when FSU was in that, here we go again with Florida State, they were in that SNIT, and they hired, I believe, a New York private investment firm, and we weren't 100% sure what they were going to do with it other than try to raise money and maybe make themselves available for another one of these conferences. But if this starts spreading around, and I realize I'm asking you to speculate, but where and how do you think it would work?
Well, again, it's an infusion of money, which obviously none of the schools are going to turn down, especially if you're going to have this next subdivision. There are going to have to be some rules. Unlike professional sports leagues and teams, you're not going to be able to sell these college athletic programs and turn them around to another buyer at some point down the road. So having guidelines in place, Paul, to be able to make sure that we do things properly, try to keep the collective under control, make sure that we're still adhering to gender equity and Title IX. Again, I believe private equity is a very viable way to try to generate these resources. But again, there's got to be guidelines so that what concerns me, Paul, are the donors. The donors that just want to win, that don't want to play by the rules, that they're not part of the institutions. They don't care if they get their hands slapped. I think these are the folks that some way, somehow, you've got to corral in. And I think the collectives have let this go a little bit.
Professor, I'm not really familiar with what you're talking about there. I'll do some research before the next time we talk, because I haven't heard of donors trying to infuse capital into programs without concern of anything. We will. This is a great conversation. I could go on all day, but I know you have to get to the basketball game. Come back soon. I have 14 other things I want to ask you, and we will do so soon. Just a pleasure to get you on the program. We've wanted to do this for a very long time. Dr. Patrick Risch, a professor and head of the study group at Washington University. We'll take a short break. Back after this.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.
And we're back. Before we go back to the calls, I just want to finish up. I know some of you know this video pretty well. 1972, I believe it was December 2nd, Alabama and Auburn. And this is Greg Gant. And that's David Lagner who picks up the ball. Same guy blocked it both times. Now the score was 16-3 the final quarter. Now Auburn trails. This is not a replay, but it's the exact same thing on the next series. Lagner again, and the number two team goes down. Their national championship hopes up in smoke. I know people talk about the kick six and the fourth in Milrow, but the context of that is simply unbelievable. that the exact same thing could happen in the same quarter. The game's over, 16-3. All you got to do is get the punt off twice. Where have we heard that one before? Let's get to Jace in Augusta, Georgia. Jace, go right ahead. Jace did not make it. How about Will up next in North Carolina? Hello, Will.
Paul, what's going on?
We are doing great. Thank you.
Randy there today?
Yeah, we're all here.
Paul, it's been a while since I talked to you, but I have a question, but I'm a deep fan and coming in from work and seeing this news about Manny Diaz. Come on.
When you go David Cutcliffe, who really was a generational coach who brought that program, then you hand over to Elko and you bring in, I mean, basically Manny Diaz is on the remainder shelf. He's a washed up head coach. He's repurposed at countless schools as a DC, and he's uninspiring.
I wish they would invite Cutcliffe back with the opportunity I had. I mean,
yeah, it's really too bad because Duke, to me, remember I've talked to Spurrier about this. I don't think Spurrier ever wanted to leave Duke. It was such a great place.
I mean, his son, I mean, I would call Steve Spurrier Jr., call Jamie Chadwell, Manny Diaz. I mean, come on. I mean, losing Elko was tough. He's a good coach, but none of my friends that I'm talking to right now, big fans. I don't care for this Manny Diaz pick at all. But
the good news for Manny Diaz, the expectations are so low that anything he does will exceed them. Rich is up next in Biloxi.
Paul. Hello.
Yes, sir. Go right ahead.
Yeah, I just saw you showed the replay of the Auburn. I remember listening to that game back in the early 70s. I've been an Alabama fan about 60 years now, and I've seen a lot of weird things happen, and that was definitely weird. And you mentioned Saban earlier about I remember, and I saw a video of him right after the Texas game, and he said that he still believed in this team and that he himself and his assistant coaches probably didn't prepare his team well enough for that game. He didn't throw anybody under the bus or anything. And whether they would have went on and won all the games and played in the playoffs or not, I was still proud of the team and Coach Saban for that statement.
Well, I think sometimes, Rich, it's frustrating to fans and the media when the coaches always echo the same thing, but they know what they're doing. They're always playing that percentage. I was texting a friend of mine who's a coach yesterday who took a terribly hard loss last week in a championship game. And instead of saying, man, we screwed up, we should have won, he said, man, I was really proud of the kids. I mean, they always keep it that way. And thanks for the call. There's a cliche in coaching to never get carried away too high with the highs or too low with the lows. And they're always playing for that that moment. Hey, let's continue. Glenn is in Florida. Hey, Glenn. Glenn is not in Florida. Daryl is also on. Hey, Daryl. I tell you what, I am now 0 for the show on getting callers on the air. I think that was my fourth one that I missed. I'm done. I'll see you Monday.
You're listening to the Paul Feinbaum Show podcast.